WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. On the web, it's 10 a.m. coming up next. Stay in... No, talk out of school. Sorry, I'm thinking about schools, a whole lot of schools. School days, stay in school. Coming up next over WBAI.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Keep it, the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down.
Good morning, my name is Leonie Hameson. Welcome to our new show, Talk Out of School, on WBAI Radio, where we will focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, at the state level, and nationally. We also want to hear from you about what issues you want us to address. Please visit our Class Size Matters Facebook page to add your thoughts, Talk Out of School Instagram page, or through Twitter with the hashtag TalkOutOfSchool. During the next hour, we'll be talking to Wendy Lecker of the Education Law Center about class size, education equity, and the lawsuit versus New York City and the state for their refusal to lower class size in city schools. In the second half of the program, we'll be talking to Senator John Liu, chair of the New York City Education Committee, who was elected as part of the Blue Wave last year. We'll be asking him about what he has planned for this year that will affect our public schools, including new legislation, hearings, or funding. These are two of the smartest people I know, and I am sure that they'll have interesting things to say. We also want you to call in at the break at 212-209-2877. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about the climate strike, which is taking place this Friday at Foley Square in downtown New York City. Everyone should take off from work and school and go downtown because climate change, in my view, is the pivotal issue of our time, and there's nothing more important. What's giving me and others a modicum of hope is the way young people, led by Greta Thunberg of Sweden and in the U.S. the Sunrise Movement, have taken hold of this issue and just won't let go until us adults do something about it. 150 countries are participating, and I hope millions of us turn up in New York City on Friday and millions of more around the world. It is that important. What's great is that the DOE has also given students the day off to attend the strike with no penalty. So that's an even better reason for all you middle school and high school students to attend and parents to bring your younger kids along. Now I'd like to introduce Wendy Lecker, who's an attorney for the Education Law Center, and last week filed an appeal in our class size lawsuit on behalf of 9 New York City parents, Class Size Matters, and AQE. Wendy, are you there?
I am. Hi, Lainey.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us today. Can you talk a little bit about our lawsuit and the issue of class size?
Sure. So just to give a little background, in this case, we, the Education Law Center, represent, as you said, 9 parents in all 5 boroughs of New York City whose children are consigned to excessively large classes in New York City public schools. Again, as you said, we also represent in this case 2 advocacy groups, Class Size Matters and the Alliance for Quality of Education, both of whom, as part of their mission, advocate for adequate resources in New York City public schools. Back in 2017, the plaintiffs in this case, the parents and the advocacy groups, sued the New York City Department of Education and the chancellor, charging that by failing to reduce class sizes in New York City public schools, they are violating a law enacted in 2007 called the Contract for Excellence Law, or the C4E law, as we call it. The C4E law has a specific provision that requires New York City, only New York City, to reduce class size. According to the law, in 2007, the New York City was supposed to have developed a plan to reduce class size across New York City public schools in three grade spans, K through 3, 4 through 8, and high school, to specific target averages. And those averages were to be achieved within 5 years. The city did develop the plan, which was approved by the state commissioner as the law requires, but unfortunately, the city failed to fulfill the plan. And now class size averages in New York City are actually larger than they were 12 years ago when the law was passed. So following the procedures outlawed in the C4E law, we first brought the case as an appeal to the State Commissioner of Education, who ruled that the law expired, even though the law is still on the books today. We then went to the State Supreme Court in Albany to appeal her decision because we contend that was a glaring legal error. And unfortunately, the court in Albany deferred to the commissioner's judgment and affirmed her decision. So now, as you said, we've appealed to the Intermediate Appeals Court, the Appellate Division, Third Department in Albany, and that's where we stand today.
So I remember clearly when we got the decision back from the judge, and I was very surprised to find that it was only a few pages long, and it basically just said, the state commissioner has really the responsibility and the authority to decide whether New York City has complied or not. And in my mind, that really wasn't a sufficient decision because it's not just the state commissioner that gets to decide on whether districts have complied with the law, is it? It's really a legal issue that belongs in the courts. Is that right?
Yes, well, even before deciding whether they complied with the law, what we believe is that the commissioner completely misread the law mm-hmm. and said essentially that this provision doesn't even apply anymore. So she doesn't even have to decide. You know, they all acknowledged, in fact, the city and the state acknowledged that this plan wasn't fulfilled.
That's right.
But what the commissioner said, which we believe is a complete misreading of the law, is that this law doesn't even apply anymore because the 5 years ran out. Even though within those 5 years, the city didn't do what it was supposed to do under the law. So,
and the fact is that the state renews that part of the law every year in the state budget. So if they believe that it, that the obligation ran out, presumably they would leave it out of current law as well. And it seems to me that if anyone can get away with complying with the law by waiting long enough and not to do it and then saying we don't have to do it anymore, that would really be, an impossible loophole for states and districts to try.
Not even a loophole. It completely nullifies the law, which,
right.
as you said, every single year is reauthorized without any change in the language, so that every year they're saying, you know, the city's still under this obligation to reduce class size pursuant to a plan within 5 years. And if you just say, you don't have to do it, it's an absurd reading of the law. Not only that, it undermines the actual goal of the C4E law, which was to actually remedy a very severe problem in New York City public schools.
Right. So can you give us a little bit more context about the issue of class size and the importance of class size in the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit, which you were also involved in the legal proceedings for. Is that right?
Correct. And you know, it's exactly right. This law stems from that, from the law, the C4E law stems from that lawsuit. So as most everybody who's listening, if they pay attention to anything to do with New York City public schools, as most listeners would know, the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit was a landmark lawsuit and a landmark decision it was brought in 1995, but the ultimate, you know, landmark decision happened in 2003. The lawsuit occurred during 1990 and 2000. But in 2003, New York State's highest court, the Court of Appeals, said that New York City's schools were underfunded and that the state underfunding of New York City public schools violated students' fundamental right to a sound basic education, which is under the New York State Constitution, the education article of the New York State Constitution. And what happened in this lawsuit was that the plaintiffs, which were, included Robert Jackson, a New York City school parent, now a state senator. The plaintiffs presented evidence that of deplorable conditions in New York City public schools, uncertified teachers, not inadequate books, and glaringly, and with the overcrowded, excessively large class size. All of these factors, including excessively large class size, led the court to say that these conditions are unacceptable and a violation of the New York State Constitution, a violation of children's constitutional rights. In fact, the court noted that tens of thousands of school children are in classes of over 30, and that represented a systemic failure of the school system.
So right now we've seen that over 300,000 students are still in classes of 30 or more. And in fact, the percentage of kids in classes of 30 or more, especially in the early grades, has risen rapidly by something like 1,000% since 2007. And so my argument would be, and I wonder if you agree with this, is that New York City schools are still not only violating the Contract for Excellence law, but violating the state constitution.
Well, certainly this, you know, this particular factor does impair a child's constitutional right to an adequate education. The fact that they're sitting in classes, tens of thousands now, you said hundreds of thousands of students are sitting in classes of 30 or more. And in fact, that is exactly why the state passed the Contract for Excellence law, the C4E law, because the court in 2003 said you not only have to reform the school funding system so New York City schools get adequate funding, but you have to develop a system to ensure that children are getting the resources that are proven to improve learning and to raise achievement. And among those resources is small class size. So that the state in 2007 said this law, the C4E law, is complying, it's our way of complying with the Campaign for Fiscal Equity decision in ensuring that there are proven programs to improve learning in those districts that get extra money. And in addition, there were not only, the C4E law didn't only apply to New York City, it applied to all districts in New York State, which were struggling, and they had to spend money in ways to raise achievement. However, for New York City, recognizing the severe problem with overcrowding and large class size in New York City, there's a specific provision that only applies to New York City that I mentioned earlier, that New York City has to develop a plan to reduce class size in three grade spans within 5 years. And that is the provision of the law, which really stems from the constitutional obligation to give kids the conditions for an opportunity for a sound basic education. That's the provision of the law that we believe that the city has been violating since
2008.
It stopped fulfilling it. Right.
And the reason for that, in my view, is that to have a special provision in the law just for New York City that focuses on class size is that New York City at that point and at still today has by far the largest class sizes in the state, so that it is less important and critical, perhaps, for some of those other districts to be reducing class size in the same way as it is for New York City schools.
Correct. I mean, the law, the legislature, and this is the legislature that wrote the law, and that's why the commissioner's reading of the law is really wrong and is not subject to any, shouldn't be subject to any deference. But the legislature would not have put a specific provision for New York City if the legislature did not feel that there was a specific issue with respect, a specific problem with respect to class size that exists in New York City. So you're 100% correct.
Now, one of the arguments by, I think, either the city or the state or both of them on their side was that at a certain point in time, then Education Commissioner David Steiner made an agreement with with DOE, which actually was a secret agreement that we just got a copy of and leaked to the press at that point, that they could hold the plan, the class size reduction plan, in abeyance because of the financial situation at that time, which was the Great Recession. And that letter, which, you know, is on my website and elsewhere if you want to look at it, basically says that this is a temporary situation. I happen to question whether giving them an out, even for the recession, was compliant with the law, which didn't allow for exceptions and did not say you have to reduce class sizes whether or not the economy is good. But in any case, it seems from the way the letter was written that this was supposed to be a temporary situation. And we have now been out of that recession for a decade, and DOE is still not reducing class size. So what would you respond to the city and the state in that regard?
Right. Well, the city and the state contend that this wasn't a temporary suspension. This was a complete change of the law. So that's an error on many, a complete change of the plan, that they amended the plan, which is a complete error on many levels. First of all, the commissioner clearly said it was temporarily, he used the word temporarily suspended. And just to back up, what the law and the original plan said was not only do you have to have this plan in three grade spans, but you also have to prioritize the struggling schools that are the most overcrowded. So from the beginning, there was a group of 75 schools that SED, the State Education Department, identified that said you have to give these schools, city, you have to give these schools priority. So what in 2010, what Commissioner Steiner said was, okay, we're going to temporarily, because of the economic situation, we're going to temporarily suspend the citywide average class size plan and for now continue to focus on those 75 schools. And what the city now and the state now contend is, oh, well, that's what they did. They replaced the school, the big plan with this target 75 plan, which is completely wrong. It's belied by the actual language of the letter sent to the city by Commissioner Steiner. Not only that, the commissioner, even if the commissioner wanted to permanently suspend that plan, the commissioner had no authority to do that. That's in the law. The commissioner cannot change. That's a state agency, can't change what the legislature has written into law. That's usurping the legislature's authority. So even if he would have wanted to make a permanent alteration to the plan, he couldn't have made that because that would have violated the actual plain language of the law.
Right. So well, one of the things, of the things that we've tracked over time is those 75 schools, which have changed over time. Unfortunately, because some of the ones originally named, they never reduced class sizes in any way, and continued to struggle, and are now closed. Other schools, more recently, they said they were going to focus their efforts on the renewal schools, which was a new list of struggling schools that was developed under Mayor de Blasio and Carmen Farina. And we did an analysis of their class sizes, and more than half of them did not reduce class sizes at all, or only reduce class sizes by a fraction of a student. So even though they say that they're working on these 75 schools, the record shows that they have not reduced class sizes in those 75 schools either. And this is a fig leaf, which they keep putting forward as saying, well, we're doing something on class size, while actually not. What's really sad is, as I mentioned, a lot of those original schools, which were on the state failing list, have now closed. The renewal school initiative did not work and is now finished. Part of the reason I believe that it did not work is they never actually did focus their efforts in those schools to lower class sizes, and many of them continue to have class sizes of 30 or more. We did a statistical analysis showing that those renewal schools that actually did offer class sizes, it was strongly correlated with a chance of actual success in terms of their impact ratings, which is their achievement and graduation rates when controlled by student background, and is a rating system that the DOE itself developed. So The renewal schools, where they did offer smaller classes, did much better, are doing much better, are still open. And those renewal schools that did not reduce class sizes, many of them either closed, are merged, or are still struggling.
Right, and this has a real human toll. This is not just statistics and numbers, but, you know, some of our parents, they, you know, every one of the parents in our suit, and this is probably, you know, I'm sure multiplied by tens of thousands, every one of these parents has a story about how the large class size has negatively impacted their children's learning experience. One parent contends, and I believe that it's, you know, she has the real proof that her son wasn't even diagnosed with a severe learning disability for years because he was languishing in a large class size, and the teacher just did not have the time and the ability to focus on each child because the class size was so large. And that story is repeated over and over again. And frankly, that's, you know, it is proven that at every stage, frankly, of a child's education, having that personal connection is key to it, not only a child succeeding, but a child remaining in school. And, you know, with all this evidence now we have of toxic stress and the impact of life experiences on a child's ability to really learn and develop in their brain in the area where learning takes place, it's, you know, the research is pretty clear that one of the greatest forces to work against the ill effects of toxic stress is a nurturing personal connection, particularly with adults. And this is exactly what cannot happen in a large class.
Right. So the research on class size, which is very, very clear, and we have links to many, many research studies on our website at classsizematters.org, show that kids that are in smaller classes do better in every single way that can be measured. They get better test scores. They better get better grades. They're less likely to be referred for special education services. They're less likely to act out and get in trouble in school in terms of disciplinary referrals. They're more likely to graduate from high school on time, go on to college, and more than 20 years later, own their own homes and have a 401k3. So the research is really marked and demonstrable. And one of the most important aspects of that research is that though all kids benefit from smaller classes, the kids that benefit the most are disadvantaged kids and students of color, which make up the majority of kids in New York City schools. So it seems to me that not only are New York City kids in general being deprived of their constitutional right for an adequate education, but the ones that are being hurt the most are the ones that are falling furthest behind. And the reason class size is so important is it's one of only a handful of education reforms which are known to narrow the achievement gap between racial and economic groups. And one of the issues that I have with this mayor and chancellor is that they talk a lot about equity and excellence and how they're moving towards equity and excellence in New York City public schools. But one of the main drivers for equity that we know, according to research and experience, is smaller classes, and yet they are doing nothing in that area.
Well, we hope that this appeal will force them to do something, to comply with the law. But as you said, the law will have, if they do comply with the law in this area, it's really going to have, we hope, and as proven by evidence in other areas, a real marked effect on children's lives. And as you said, it's not only their academic lives, but it's their life outcomes beyond school.
Yeah, so I'd like to take a bit of a break now, and can you stay on, Wendy, in case?
Sure.
We're going to take a bit of a break. This is WBAI-FM. We will be back soon with Wendy and Senator John Liu. Again, please call in at 212-209-2877. This is WBAI 99.5. 5 FM, listener-supported Pacifico Radio. We will be back in a few minutes.
She, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down.
get out of your seat. Down the hall and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
Hi, this is Talk Out of School with Leonie Hameson on WBAI FM 99.5 Pacifica Radio. We've been talking to Wendy Lecker of the Education Law Center, and now we'd like to bring in Senator John Liu of Queens. Senator John Liu was elected as part of the Blue Wave, a progressive Democrats that were elected last year, but he's not new to politics. Formerly, he was a council member from Queens, from the city council, and then after that, the city controller. So, Senator Liu, are you with us?
I am, Lainey. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Can you first explain a little bit the difference, what it's like being a state senator versus a council member or a city controller?
So you basically started off by saying that I'm not fresh, that I've been around for a while now, and now you want me to compare my previous experiences. Happy to do so. The state senate is actually I will concede it's been far more exciting than I thought it would be, and I think that's because we have a new Democratic majority, and in 2019, under the leadership of Andrea Stewart Cousins, we got a whole lot done.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more than I ever anticipated. How it's different from the city council is that the city council was a very special place for me also. It was my first office. The city council is just basically one party and one chamber, whereas in the state senate, we still, even though we're in the majority, we still do have Republican colleagues, and we also have to work with the other house, which the assembly, which thankfully is in Democratic hands as well.
Mm-hmm.
And nonetheless, there are, even though we're the same party, there are two separate houses that bills have to get through, and sometimes there are differences of opinion in the majority, in the respective majorities of the chambers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly something that's very different. Another thing that's different from the city council is that the state legislature, it is most of the laws that govern our daily lives come from the state. And that's not only true in New York. State laws are really the laws that we live under primarily on a day-to-day basis. So the laws that we are able to enact in state government are, I would say, much more impactful and far-reaching.
Right.
So those are a couple of differences that I have experienced and observed. As far as how this is different from my comptroller days, the comptroller is a singular position in New York City. It's, you know, it's not quite the executive branch, which is really the mayor, but it's almost like a smaller executive branch. It's independent, so it's independent of the mayor. It's independent of the legislature, meaning the city council. And it was a big office.
Mm-hmm.
Big office with over 700 professionals, with a large budget and some substantial statutory responsibilities. So so it's very difficult to even compare being a state senator to being comptroller.
So as you mentioned, there was lots of terrific legislation, progressive legislation that was passed in the last legislative session on housing, climate change, reproductive rights, and a lot more. But nothing much changed about public education, unless I missed it. Can you take us behind the curtain in Albany over the negotiations over the budget, for example, and some of the other issues like mayoral control that came to you for decision-making?
Okay, so first and foremost, if you are the Lainey Hampton that I know, nothing's going to get past you. So you didn't miss anything. In terms of the educational bills or legislation affecting education, I think we had significant legislation. The mayoral control, or what we like to call school governance, was extended for 3 years with some significant changes that seek to bolster both accountability as well as parental input and engagement. It was not necessarily landmark legislation as the Reproductive Health Act would be, or the Climate Climate Protection Act would be. Those really, I mean, you know, if you looked at the how much work went into crafting legislation, negotiating to get legislation passed, those are landmark pieces of legislation. Mm-hmm. An extension of school governments, I agree with you, it's not landmark, but nonetheless, it's significant. So I wouldn't say that there's not much that happened on the educational front, just not as perhaps noticeable as some of the other pieces of legislation.
For our listeners, could you just describe what the changes were in the school governance bill so that
Sure. Everybody
knows?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of different provisions and changes in that extension bill, the extension of mayoral control / school governance, which, again, is an extension of a system that had been in place since 2002. Enacted by the state legislature since 2002, significantly changed in 2009, tweaked along the way, and then again changed this year. For example, it includes changes to the terms of the members of the panel for educational policy, how CECs could review decisions by district superintendents, and the terms of office of CEC members, including members whose children may have graduated out of public school but still have a portion of their term remaining, to requirements that the chancellor give explanations about decisions that they made which overturned the wishes and the resolutions of local CECs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge list of them, Lainey. I don't pretend to remember 6 months after we passed the bill every single item.
Right. Well,
but
one
course,
thing
if
that
anybody's
was
anybody's interest.
Yeah, one thing that was good that I did notice was that CEC members are going to be voted on, hopefully, by all parents in the schools from now on. I don't know that that has happened yet, but I think that there is a requirement in the law that that happen soon. Is
yes,
that right?
And there is a mechanism for for finalizing the details of those provisions, exactly how the parents would be engaged in the voting process.
Right. Now, one thing that I hate to harp on this issue, but this is an issue of very strong importance for a lot of parents, the issue of marital control, because many of us believe there are not sufficient checks and balances on his or her sole authority, no matter, you know, who the mayor is. Our democratic system in general, we believe, relies on checks and balances. And right now, the mayor gets all his authority from the state, and even the city council has very, very little power to affect education policy, unlike every other city agency. And I know that when you were in the city council and when you ran for mayor, you were, you know, as a mayoral candidate, you were one of the very few, if not the only one, who said we do need substantial changes to the system to allow for significant checks and balances on the mayor's unilateral authority over our schools. Do you still believe that, or has that changed over time?
Of course I still believe it. My belief in having checks and balances is not limited to school governance. It's limited to all aspects of government, schools being the most important responsibility of government. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with those who say that, oh, mayoral control or this idea that, or the current iteration of school governance as passed by the state legislature gives the Mayor carte blanche.
Mm-hmm.
You have seen already in these last several months a renewed vigor with which the state legislature is looking at education policy, even within the city of New York. So that there is clearly going to be a significant amount of oversight coming from the state legislature, from the Assembly, and now from the Senate.
Can you talk a little bit about what kind of oversight you see coming our way in terms of the state legislature and what we can expect for this session?
Well, one issue that apparently is rearing its head, I don't want to say if it's ugly or nice looking, is the issue of gifted and talented programs. It's become a hot-button issue, which was precipitated by the admissions results to the specialized high schools. Now it's become a broader issue, which it always should have been.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that is under, if you only limit the thinking to mayoral control, sure, the mayor has total control over it. But on the other hand, there are things that we could do in the state legislature that at least provide significant oversight over what the mayor does about the schools.
So
to the extent that we need to impose some constraints, that's something that the state legislature is fully capable of doing.
So last week we did focus on the proposals of the School Diversity Advisory Group on eliminating or radically changing the gifted and talented program, especially in elementary schools, and ending screened middle schools. Do you personally have a position on that issue, these issues?
No, I don't have a position on that issue because it's emerging.
Uh-huh.
The advisory group has some good insight, and it has some insight that really hasn't been fleshed out fully. So in the coming months, this is an issue that I expect to explore in greater detail.
So another issue that obviously affects our schools hugely that the state legislature has authority over is state aid to our schools.
Yes.
There was some disappointment that there wasn't a significant increase in state aid to New York City schools in the last session, and some would argue that the state is still not equitably funding New York City schools and other high-need schools across the state and is still not really complying with the Campaign for Fiscal Equity decision, which Wendy talked about a few minutes ago. What's your position on school funding, and can you take us a little bit behind the curtain in Albany when there are negotiations over the budget and especially school aid? Senator Liu, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good.
Okay. I wouldn't necessarily say that this occurred. There's far more transparency that there has been in the past with regard to state budgeting. In fact, a lot of times, you know, members of the state legislature would be getting information from news outlets and from advocates such as yourselves during the budget process. Now, with regard to your first question, we are not in compliance. We are in violation. We are in violation of a court order that requires schools in New York State to be funded so that an adequate amount of education can be provided for all children in this state. At the time, we are a little less than $4 billion out of compliance. And so it is a priority of the legislature to get to a point where we can include the entire additional $4 billion. And over the last few years, including this year, there have been increases every single year, so to get us closer to compliance. But as I said before, we're still shy of $4 billion out of compliance.
Okay.
What didn't help this year was the imposition of a property tax cap, as well as some limitations in what I would call them relatively artificial limitations in how our budget can grow from year to year. So that's something I think we need to look at because ultimately we do need to satisfy the court mandate sooner rather than later. And I believe it is the vast majority of state legislators would like to get there sooner rather than later. We can't get there overnight, but we're certainly going to get there quicker than we would have been able to without the new Democratic majority in the state Senate.
Oh, absolutely. So in a minute, we'd like to open up the phone lines. Please call in now with your questions or concerns to Wendy Lecker or Senator Liu at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Now, Senator Liu, if you could give advice to us advocates on the ground, what we should be doing differently or what we should be doing more of in order to really make positive change for our schools, including the billions of dollars which you say the schools are owed. What should we be doing differently, if anything?
Lainey, you are a longtime advocate, as well as many of the other people that I've had the privilege of working with closely, including our friends from the Alliance for Quality Education, and the various CECs, including the ECC. All these advocacy groups are very effective, as they are, in terms of getting out information to legislators, and sometimes more importantly, allowing legislators to understand what is being perceived and what's understood and what people are not happy with on the ground, the view of parents as well as other school stakeholders. So I would say continue to do that. One thing that we have tried to, as legislators, try to impart upon our allies, including yourself, is that we are a new Democratic majority in the state Senate,
right,
but we don't have any blank checks. And so as much as we'd like to take care of this court mandate, we're going to have to get to it in stages. And our job is to get to that point as quickly as possible. That means making some choices, some things that we may have to go without. So there are lots of competing priorities. I think we all understand that mass transit and our infrastructure continues to be a really high priority among New Yorkers. We also have a huge outstanding question on health care in this state and the New York Health Act. And then, of course, the housing crisis, particularly right. in public housing and also the lack of affordable housing in general. These are all huge and important competing priorities for the budget. So when I, you know, as much as education is my top priority, and it's always been my top priority running for office and serving in office, I know it's not the only thing. So we have to make some really difficult choices when we're taking votes and when we're trying to figure out what should go in the bills that we ultimately call a vote on. And to the extent that advocates could understand the kinds of pressures we go through, that, I think, is always constructive, never destructive in any way.
Right. Well, I've been an advocate for a long time, but I still believe that I don't really understand politics, and I don't think I'm very good at it. So whatever advice you can give us, I would really, really appreciate. One thing I did hear from you the other night in an event was that even though you do have Democratic control of the Senate, you do not have veto-proof control, which I assume you meant you can override vetoes by the governor. And I don't know whether you want to talk about that or not, but many people believe that it's the governor, and he's been pretty public about that, thinking that schools are getting enough school aid and we don't really need any more school aid, and that may be a barrier to getting us the budget and school aid and the equitable school aid that we need.
I feel like I should just let it stand right there.
Okay.
Because you laid it out so well. But I will say something. I mean, it was disheartening for me to hear from our chief executive early on this year that he thought the CFE mandate had been completely funded and it was no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the way he entered the budget discussions this past session. So I would agree with you when you say that it didn't seem like it was a really high priority for him. The other thing we talked about earlier, this idea that, expenditures can't grow more than 2% a year, that's not a legal constraint. There's nothing constitutional about it. That is a gubernatorial edict.
Right.
We can do a lot of things. We can want to do a lot of things and actually pass things. But ultimately, if the governor refuses to go along, then he refuses. So we put in our conference, under Andrea's leadership, a goal of achieving not only retaining our members in the next election, meaning, you know, the election that is literally months away.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the primary and a little more than a year away in the general, we want to retain our members and add to the majority that we have so that we can override gubernatorial vetoes. And I think if we take the long view, meaning, you know, not decades, but a couple of more years longer than we would have hoped for, I think we can achieve things that are far more impactful and what many of us would like to see, myself included, happen in the state of New York. So getting that veto-proof majority, to override a veto, you need to have a two-thirds majority vote. There are 63 senators. Two-thirds of that is 42. 43 is probably a safer number just because let's just say 43 is a safer number. And 44 would even be a better number. Well, we have to have at least 42 override the veto, and we're at 40 right now, 40 Democrats in the Congress.
So we're going to now open up the lines for callers. We have a caller on the line, a WBAI FM. You're on the air. What's your name, where you're calling from, and what is your question, please?
Richard from Manhattan.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Rainey. So forgive me,
Richard. Could I ask you to please speak a little bit louder?
This came up already, but in terms of the degree of mayoral control of the school system.
Laney, I'm sorry, I can't hear the question that well.
Panel for Educational Policy is eight.
Richard, could you speak a little bit louder? Senator Lucy.
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Yes, that's a lot better.
Okay. So in terms of mayoral control of the school system, the current and the degree of mayoral control, the current makeup of the Panel for Educational Policy is eight mayoral appointees and one each from the five borough presidents. What if there were appointees from the city council, the controller, the public advocate, parents, and maybe even students, so that the mayor had not a majority of appointees, but less than a majority of appointees? Wouldn't that help to diversify the opinions and authority going into making decisions about the DOE?
Okay, so, I mean, that's a great question, and that idea comes up quite a bit. The pushback we get is that when we say mayoral control, it's not so much about mayoral control as it is about mayoral accountability. And this is one of the main concepts that Michael Bloomberg pushed when he successfully engaged the legislature to give him folks control. He was saying that, well, if he has control, then it's very clear who to blame if something goes wrong with our schools. So if Mayor de Blasio or any other future mayor has control, that mayor also is accountable for what's happening in our schools. If we take control away, meaning we give the mayor less than a majority of the appointees on the panel, which ultimately makes the decisions that govern our schools, then we'll be taking away accountability as well. And in some ways, we go back to the old Board of Education where it wasn't clear who, if anyone, was to blame. So I'm not necessarily saying that as my own strong opinion. I'm saying that as how it has transpired over the last nearly two decades and what control really means. Control and accountability go together. If you take some of the control away, then perhaps necessarily you're also taking away some of the accountability.
So the same argument could be used for a unitary executive. For example, President Trump could have complete control over all federal policies, and we wouldn't need a Congress because that distributes authority in a way that Trump could then blame the Congress, which he does, if something doesn't happen that he wants to happen. So personally, I don't buy that argument. I've heard it many times. And originally, when mayoral control was first proposed, there was a lot of back and forth fighting between the mayor and the Board of Education, which was, I thought, a distraction from what needed to happen. But whenever you have checks and balances, that means distributed authority, and that essentially means that the voters have to decide who to blame, whether the mayor or the legislature, or whatever, the executive or the legislature. So I'm not clear that that's the best argument, though I've heard it before. One of the things that really gets to me, and I think probably gets to you, Senator Liu, is the fact that every single month the PEP votes on contracts. And that was one of the amendments made to mayoral control a few years ago when it was renewed, because we had a lot of no-bid contracts and, as it turned out, some corruption in some of those contracts and a lot of wasteful spending, which I think you were one of the main people to point out. And still to this day, the PEP has never turned down a contract. So they go through this rigmarole, this kabuki theater, some people would call it, of voting on all the contracts every single month, but they never turn one down. So,
by the way, am I still on? Could I make one response?
Yeah, but why don't you let Senator Liu respond to that one first, and then you can go
on.
Sure.
All right. First of all, I appreciate your thoughts, Lenny, on the mayoral control accountability issue. I will say, though, that there is accountability in legislative oversight. As far as the contracts go, it used to also be that, for example, the comptroller's office, which looks at contracts from every other city agency, mm-hmm. didn't have any kind of insight or role to play in Department of Education contract. That is also different now. So, yes, you're right that PEP still seems to be just a rubber stamp. But there is a contract registration and ultimately an audit process that is part of city government as well, and that's in the comptroller's office. So I wouldn't say that there's no oversight there.
No and, oversight from the PEP, I meant.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't know if we could get to the point where PEP could have contracting is very technical. So you need to have contracting experts both in the DOE as well as an outside entity, which in this case would be the city comptroller's office.
Right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you both, Wendy and Senator Liu, for being with us today. Unfortunately, we don't have time for any more questions. This has been Talk Out of School on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacific Radio. Thank you again to our guests, Wendy Lecker and Senator Liu. We hope you'll join us next week at 10 a.m., where I'll be talking with Councilmember Mark Traeger, Chair of the New York City Council Education Committee, and some experts about the problem of lead in our schools. If you like the show, don't forget to sign up online as a BAA buddy for Talk Out of School. And thanks for listening in.
Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the hall and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Into the slot.
Hey, kid.
You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long, you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old. Drums loud and bold.
Court, John McDonough, New York, We and Thee, coming up just a moment over WBAI.
I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio. With no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile. I was anxious to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere. And she leaned and whispered in my ear. Cuddling more and driving slow. With no particular place to go.
Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really going to spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free tote bag. The BAI buddy card allows you to become eligible for on-air giveaways and receive discounts at local shops, museums, and venues. And that's not even the best part.